Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Today I talked to Janet Morton and Annie Dunning, two artists who didn't write the book On the Ward, but they did coordinate its creation in chapbook form from PS Guelph called Mapping the Ward. That book, which was subtitled A Neighborhood in Transition, came out about 2.5 years ago, and the transition hasn't stopped in that time. In fact, you could almost make a case that the transition is increasing in scope and changing the character of that beloved area of the city. The new ward is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. St. Patrick's Ward, which is also known by just the ward, is one of the oldest parts of the city and is one of the places in Guelph that is seeing a lot of rapid changes. With Guelph growing quickly, areas already built up like the ward are not just seeing an influx of new faces, but a shifting of the look and feel of their neighborhoods. Now, some of the names stay the same, like Biltmore. It was once a hat factory, and now it's a pending condo development. Old buildings are being kept for their footprint, but are being converted for new purposes, like the old Uniroyal plan, which will soon become a different condo development. Still, these are the same skinny streets that have been around since the post-war era, an area built up after World War II, and the industrial-filled spoils of industry on one side of the street, and entire neighborhoods of families on the other. Yes, the world is changing, but people are notoriously unable to accept change as it's happening. And I began thinking about this again a few weeks ago when a group called We Are the Ungovernable went on a tirade damaging property and threatening passersby in the Lock Street area of Hamilton. This area of Hamilton used to be working class, affordable, but in recent years it's seen an influx of new money to the area. New businesses have popped up, vacancy rates have gone down, rents have increased, and some of the longtime residents have been pushed out as consequence. As the media looked for anarchists, they overlooked class-based tensions in the neighborhood, and it begged the question, in me at least, is there any tension like that here in Guelph? So I reached out to the experts. This week on the Guelph Politicast, I talked to Janet and Annie about mapping the ward, the changes they see around them, and how they and their neighbors feel about those changes. Plus, whether or not there's any resentment among longtime residents of the ward about the changes coming through now. I hardly expect the ward to erupt in black bloc scale rioting, but I wondered if this also might be an election issue. What might the future of this area look like if these trends continue? So I caught up with Annie Dunning and Janet Morton last week in studio.
My name's Annie Dunning, and I'm a local Guelph artist who lives in the ward, and I worked in collaboration with Janet to produce a book, The Mapping the Ward Project.
My name's Janet Morton, and I am also a resident of the ward. I've lived there for almost 13 years. And worked with Annie on the Mapping the Ward project, where in collaboration with the Two Rivers Neighborhood Group, we gathered and created images and interviews, trying to address the changing, the moment of that things are really on the cusp of major change in our neighborhood.
And that was a couple of years ago now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to establish the conversation, what made you want to do a chapbook and document those changes, and what was your inspiration?
Well, when I moved to the ward, some of the factories were still open. The Biltmore factory was there and operational. I bought a hat there. The Woods factory was still open and running. And we both moved to that area around the same time, within a couple of years of each other, and saw those factories close and learned a little bit more about other factories that had disappeared, like the Imico site. And just seeing the empty lots, the demolished lots, and wondering what's to come, we just decided it was a good point to look at the neighborhood in transition, to gather community memories and histories of people who had been there before we had been there, mm-hmm. and to try and compile a sort of a social history of the neighborhood as we look towards what was coming in, what these big changes were going to be.
It's so interesting when you travel down York Road. It's, you know, the past, you can visualize it so easily because there's the houses on one side and then all the big lots where the factories used to be and where all the small businesses were, and, you know, on the other side of the street, it's, you know, the footprint's still there. It's really easy to visualize.
Yeah, and we spoke to some people who had, there's an interview in this book of a gentleman who moved from Italy to the ward and worked at Fiberglass Canada, which is now the Owen Corning factory.
Mm-hmm.
And he bought his house there so that he could walk to work and not require a second car in the family. And and he's still there today, and he's still gardening like crazy, making his own wine and making his own prosciutto and all of that kind of stuff, that tradition. And so it was neat to talk to people like that who'd seen.
Yeah.
What we missed. What was there before we came.
But even, I just think in the you know, dozen years that I've lived in the ward, I sort of felt like maybe you and I both arrived at a similar moment, that there was a lot of change happening. Like, when we moved onto the street, there were more of the people who had been there for years. On my street, there were several people. There was a woman who was almost 100 who had been in her home practically since it was built by her parents. And there was our neighbor that Annie referred to just now, Tarcisio, and who's featured in the book. And you know, there was another neighbor, John, who'd lived there for close to 60 years, and he's now moved. And in place of some of those people who'd been there for generations and decades, there is now this huge influx of young families. Like, there are so many kids that weren't there a decade ago.
Which is a change of character in a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I think, you know, the history of there being a lot of older Italian families in the neighborhood and student housing. We were flanked by student houses when we bought our house, and that's changed too. And they've been, the houses, like, the beside us bought, fixed up.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it almost sounds like it went back in that particular sense where, you know, you had people moving in when they were a young couple or just starting a family, and then they grew old in that house, and now it's going back to young families again. There was, you know, you kind of managed to get in there during that transition. You know, I'm also wondering about, because one of the things we hear about now is, you know, the walkable communities and having a diverse community where it's not just where you live in this part of the city and you work in this part of the city and you shop in this part of the city. There's you know, you try to balance the and here we have the ward, which has, you know, a long history of, you know, that gentleman you mentioned. He wanted to work where he lived and was quite comfortable doing that. Except, you know, I wonder, is that character being lost too? Because that's the appeal of this area, or it was the appeal, and now they're, you know, what we're looking at is sort of the epicenter in town of the condo boom, or at least one of the epicenters.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think another appeal of the neighborhood has always been affordability.
Mm.
And it's not just Italians. There's all different immigrants who came to that area because it was the affordable place to move into. And I think that's what drew our wave of young families there. It was the only place we could afford to buy a house.
The inner city.
Yeah, so that's part of it. But the way we live has changed greatly since Tarcisio moved to the neighborhood and bought his house and raised his family and lived in the same spot. We're so much more transient now.
Mm.
The way we shop is different. You can order things delivered to your door.
Yeah.
You don't need to walk downtown to get whatever.
True enough.
But I also think, like, one of the things that I'm really concerned with is that I see we're at this moment of transition, and ideally there'll be a plan for some infrastructure to promote more of that local culture. And there's a real resistance to it. And it has to do with traffic flow and parking and all those things, because I know I actually don't know what the update on the Biltmore project was. I know that several plans went through and were rejected. Mm. And some of that was because folks like myself were calling counselors and writing City Hall saying, make sure we have a coffee shop and a store that you can get more than what you can get at the convenience store at. Yeah. So there can be some hubs. And in the end, I don't know, you know, the response that I got was all about, well, where will those people park and how will that impact traffic flow on York Road? But in the neighborhood, there used to be the White's Grocery Store that then later became the Box Meat Revolution store for years. And that's been now sitting. Somebody bought it, and it's been sitting empty for a few years now.
And painted over that Box Meat Revolution.
Finally, just this year they've started to put
insulation over it. It's sort of being picked off, though. I think somebody sort of pulled some of it off.
Yeah, there were chunks on the sidewalk the other day when I went by. But there's these local businesses that, you know, it would be so amazing if more things moved in. Like, we've got one of the things that's moved in is the best Thai food, probably in Ontario, is right there in the ward. But there needs to be hubs for people to, you know, walk and stay within their community. And there's, I think because there is this transition happening, there is an opportunity for that, but it's not part of the larger ethos of development. Like, we haven't learned from Jane Jacobs, really. Like, we allowed the South End to be built the way it is.
Right.
We've allowed the East End to be developed. You know, so all of those developments don't have, those walkable amenities. You have to go to those.
Yeah, there's an element of miscommunication here. What you're saying is, you know, we want some place in our neighborhood where we can gather. Mm-hmm. And the city's like, yeah, but what about everyone else in the city who might want to come here? And it's not necessarily about that. It's about helping the area and people who just want to go somewhere to sit that they can walk to. And
yeah, but a great example of that miscommunication is Lion Park. Mm. Okay, it's the only outdoor swimming pool in the city. It's been there since, I think, the 50s. Right beside you swim there in the summer, you hear the factory humming, and there is the park in front of it that used to be a much more multi-use park. Mm. And then some decision was made at City Hall without community consultation, and it's now probably the slickest ball diamonds anywhere in this city with no real place to park.
Right.
And ball diamonds, not for people using
it's for leagues and clubs.
It's not for the neighborhood. And because they built it so high end with built-in sprinkler systems, we can no longer have a community rink there because that might impact these perfect fields. It took out the topography, which means the kids who used to do their mini tobogganing on the little slightly rolling, you know, hills can no longer do that.
Right.
And, you know, it feels more like a prison yard than anything else because the lights, the fences are so high and really, like, it's this overkill and totally a misread of what's going on in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like also a misread of what the tradition of the neighborhood is, and also the intention of the park, that if you're building a park that's meant to keep certain people out at, you know, at certain times, it sort of defeats the purpose of the park, which is supposed to be an open space anyone can use anytime. It's you know, talking about Biltmore and things, one of the things that strikes me about what's going on in the ward is that we do like to use sort of the footprints of what's been there in the past. You know, the old Woods factory where they're building the metal works, you know, they're using, you know, elements of that have been around for over a century. Biltmore is, you know, this development being named after the thing that was a very famous Guelph thing that used to be on the site. I don't want to say it's like cultural appropriation, But I can imagine there's an element here that's like a bit of like a cynical, you know, corporate recycling of these things that are like landmarks in this area people care about, and we're turning it into meaning these new things that the area may not necessarily be on board with, as you're saying, with the Biltmore development, which is, you know.
I think that always happens with development. Maybe it's a nod to the history, but I think for the people who remember the history, it's more of a blatant marker of what's been lost. And it's like when a new subdivision goes in and they call it Deer Chase Park or whatever, and it's like, yeah, you chased all the deer out of this park and put up row houses.
Pinecrest. Fox Valley.
Yeah. I hope someone's somewhere taking notes.
With the Biltmore, I know it was still open and functioning when we moved into the neighborhood as well. And then part of this Mapping the Ward project, one of the things Annie and I and a couple others went down to the Guelph Archives and like did research on the homes that we'd lived in. And I found out that somebody had lived in my home for about 40 years, actually walked down the alley and worked at the Biltmore for all those years.
Okay.
And during some of our renovation, we actually found between walls a couple of hats, which is kind of this cool, you know, connection to that space. I was checking the website for the Biltmore, and their factory style, like the design choice, is to kind of make it look almost like it was a 1940s style factory, but they're all being built to the net zero,
right?
And with built-in garages into that factory look, and the low price is $700,000.
Mm.
Like that's going up from there.
Right.
So they're looking at a very different demographic that have been the traditional, residents of the ward.
Yeah, not exactly working class. One of the things I wanted to spur me to talk about the ward was what happened in Hamilton a couple of weeks ago, and I think it was sort of missed by the media coverage, is that, you know, we have these areas that have been traditionally working class, traditionally drawing immigrants and people who are not people of means, and you get developers who move in, and you know, it's great when an area can sort of be reclaimed and rejuvenated, but, you know, we still, you know, lose a lot of people, and a lot of the people who establish the character of the area. So I'm wondering, you know, you guys live in the ward, and you have, you know, you talk to your neighbors, I presume. you did certainly talk to your neighbors for your book, but, you know, are they concerned that, you know, the things that drew them to the ward in the first place, whether that is affordability, whether that is character, are they concerned about losing those things in the midst of, you know, what's going on with the development?
I don't know if...
Well, are you concerned? Like, are you concerned, like, you know, the ward may come a day it doesn't feel like home anymore?
Well, I worry as there's more and more rules about what you can do in your backyard, that, like, in our neighborhood, there's a lot of people that keep chickens and do all kinds of strange things and...
Such as
farming, basically farming their backyard. But that's part of the character of the neighborhood. These experimental, like, people missed a food from home, and so they tried to produce it themselves.
Right.
We even heard rumors about Vietnamese immigrants who were trying to grow rice in the ward for a time. And
wow.
Like really ambitious little projects, but I guess municipal regulation seems to be getting more and more strict. There's a new license for chickens now. They've banned outdoor fires, which was kind of a characteristic of the ward area. Mm-hmm. There were always backyard fires when we first moved.
And like a really big thing is the loss of a community school, which is something really, you know, that I think is a kids who grew up in that neighborhood walked over to Tytler.
Right.
And it's kind of been in holding that building for a couple of years.
Yeah.
I wonder if that will be reinstated or With all the new housing that's being put in, we're going to need... They're going to bus everybody out.
Well, I think, yeah, they're going to need to probably consider that in the long term because there are... If we think about how many people are going to be living in that metalworks, I kind of feel like a lot of those places are being marketed to Toronto commuters, right? So how will they really be members of the community? I'm not sure.
That's probably a bigger issue.
With the Biltmore, and that's why there's this, and there's other infill projects like the old Canadian Rubber Factory at the corner of Huron and Alice. It also has some drawings hung up on it now, and they've cleared the land around it, and they're remediating it. That's just, you know, happened in the last few months, hauling away old soil, bringing in new soil. And I know there's big plans for the Imico site off Beverly. Off Stevenson and Beverly. And along Stevenson, there are some long-term plans for commercial things along there, I think. But... it seems like the housing developers went out, like.
Right. You know, and you're right because I don't think there's anything in the metalworks material that sells, you know, great location, you know, near great schools or near, you know, that kind of thing. It's about the being adjacent to downtown where there's, you know, shops and
the
entertainment
transit
and transit hub. Yeah.
To Toronto.
And most of those places in the metalworks, they're 2-bedroom max. Mm-hmm. I was looking at the floor plans for the Biltmore just because I was curious to see who they're looking for. And those are 3 bedrooms. So they are looking towards, encouraging families to be moving in there. And I've heard various plans about the Imico site too that include multi sort of sizes or scales.
They are talking about affordable housing
and
some kind of draw there. Although there is the broader debate about what is affordable, but Tyler is a big piece of this because that is history. That is heritage.
It's the oldest school, I think, in the city.
Right. So you can't just doze it and throw up something. And you can't really... I mean, I think there are, correct me if I'm wrong, accessibility issues.
There are accessibility issues and infrastructure issues. Like the washrooms and plumbings are a big issue in that building and the fact that it's not accessible at present. And they're running... ESL programs out of there now and continuing ed programs out of there. Like this year, it's being used more than it has in the last few years. And there was a major remediation project that went on that they were cleaning out the ground under the school.
I know it's
a historic building. It needs to be preserved. But as the school in the community, it really served as a center for a lot of people. And then for years, the Two Rivers Neighborhood Group has been housed out of that. And that space is a little bit in jeopardy for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I mean, the school thing, because, you know, I walked to school. I didn't live next door to the school. It was a 20-minute walk down the street. But, you know, you walk to school, and I think that's, but one of the big paradigm shifts is that, you know, you get on a bus now and, you know, there are kids who get on the bus at 7:30 in the morning in order to get to school for 8:30. It's bizarre. Let's leave the school there. In terms of, you know, what's going on, you know, in the ward and expectations, this is a political podcast, so I do like to try and keep it political when we exhaust all other topics of conversation. But, you know, your Ward 1 counselors, Bob Bell has his shop in the ward.
He's relocated in the neighborhood, which is great.
I think the concern is very much on the newer developments further east, you know, when we're talking about Victoria Road and Watson and area. Do you think the concerns of where you are in the ward proper, do you think that's, like, in terms of the type of development, the swiftness of development, the price range of some of the developments are looking at, do you think that's going to be an election issue? Or you know, anyone you think is going to press that point to making, you know, the heritage of the ward an election issue?
I don't know if it'll be an election issue, but it's definitely on the minds of ward residents. I'm not sure about the larger community.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds but what it sounds like is that the ward's fairly laid back about, you know, the two of you have gone to great pains mm-hmm. to document the changes, mm-hmm. but there's sort of, you know, it almost feels like there's like, well, if it happens, it happens.
it I think there's a lot of nice little businesses that are popping up in the ward, though. I mean, you mentioned the Thai restaurant. There's also the Eritrean catering company.
Right.
There's a new coffee shop just off of Elizabeth Street, which is quite nice. The Appetizingly Yours mm-hmm. catering satellite store.
Mm-hmm. And Video relocating into the ward is mm-hmm. great.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we have Royal City, and I know people in the neighborhood love to walk there with their jugs and get their own beer, you know, and
right.
bike over. I certainly feel like that there should be this infrastructure right in the heart of it, and it's just, you know, I don't know whether it's laid backness necessarily, but you know, in the whole squeaky wheel getting the grease thing, I kind of feel like if people had been able to rally a little bit more about insisting Tytler stay open as a public school,
right.
that might have happened. It's, you know, like, not to use the overused phrase of capacity building, but, you know, it's a bit about that, like, who has the energy to lobby and what are their, if you're dealing with people who are kind of financially struggling more, then they tend to have less ability to have energies for lobbying, perhaps.
Right.
I mean, that's a very general kind of political. They may have strong feelings,
right.
but actually getting there to make their voice heard is another question. I guess that I want to raise.
I think you're right, and I think another thing to include in that is cynicism, is that, you know, I know that there are a number of people down in the Niska Road area who are upset that council didn't listen to, or felt like that the council didn't listen to their concerns about taking out the one lane bridge there, even though the you know, there's a strong argument made that Bailey Bridge was necessitated a replacement. But, you know, it's hard for, I think, for people to think that, you know, you can't fight City Hall on the when you're battling over neighborhood concerns, that it's always the
big
picture.
Well, it does seem like the developers always have
right.
endless time and resources to lobby mm-hmm. for what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And the city is making a profit as they are making a profit. So
right.
things seem to move hand in hand.
And there is this mandate towards density, right?
Right.
And like, I totally get that, and I think that that's positive, but it has to come with some kind of consultation process. And I bring up the park again because people who live on the streets bordering the park weren't even given a survey. They weren't asked a question, and that would not have happened if you lived at Exhibition Park
right.
or if Sunny Acres Park. There's no way. Right. And
of course, those are the people who suffer if there's, as you said, there's no parking. So because they're the ones who their street fills up with cars parking.
Or the field lights are on.
Sure.
That are, you know, kind of like Wrigley Field lights. You know, like, it's so overkill. You can be in somebody's backyard and see the effects of the lights they've put in.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes even the consultation processes seem so unreceptive. I mean,
right.
Mico Valeriot Park, which is also mm-hmm. in the ward, is about to get a remake.
Yep.
They're taking out the wading pool, which has serious infrastructure problems and needs to be updated. But
but
the consultation, because I live right across the street from that park, I got the survey and I looked at the options and they're very similar. Like, we're going to cut down all the mature trees, we're going to re-landscape, and we're going to put a circular paved path in the middle of the park so people can walk in circles. And so, you know,
I'm not sure how that's the phrase it, but
maybe that's not exactly their plan. But it feels like the options are very limited.
Right.
And the suggestions, I don't know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. With these sort of consultations, it feels like the decision is like half made in terms of we have a very narrow...
Right.
And again...
There's three choices.
Right.
Do you want the circle over here or over here? Or do you want...
You're right, and but
a
I'm,
pine tree or a maple tree.
I do wonder if that's a function of, you know, the regulations governing what can be done, mm-hmm. and then by the time it does get to the people, that you know your options are already so limited because when they went into the process on their end, the options were so limited. But you know, it's yeah. I think when people think of public engagement, they think like starting with a blank sheet of paper, not
like
starting
a brainstorm with, session yeah. where people think of what they would want.
Yeah,
it's already well underway.
Right. And or, you know, and it also could be a function of we don't want, you know, we want to give it 100 surveys and get some idea of what the direction is and not 100 different ideas about what the direction people want.
Right.
But I mean, that's a fault of government thinking, I guess, is or the way government thinks.
It's a practicality.
Yeah. Is there anything you'd hate to lose in the war? Like, you know, it's, you know, you ever look around and go, oh, that'd be a shame if that wasn't there anymore. The 100 steps, I think, is a big one that, you know, was sort of a, I don't know, flash before your eyes thing that last fall.
Yeah, I was
fall.
Pretty worried when they closed it that it might never reopen.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's some of the community pressure you were talking about.
Yeah. And, you know, that was one of those things that this city, when it closed in August, I know I spoke to City Hall and they said, it'll be open by the end of September. And then, but then it became, oh, we don't actually own that bridge. It's
right.
owned by the rail company and
yep.
they need to replace it.
Mm-hmm.
So then it became a 6-8 month process rather
yeah.
than, you know, which is great. And I'm just curious whether the city will now repair the stairs,
mm.
you know, because mm-hmm. the stairs are a hazard now.
Yeah.
But we'll see. Now they have this beautiful bridge up at the top.
Great new bridge. It's also, I mean, it's sort of an opportunity. It's a great corridor, a pedestrian corridor, and I'm sure the city wants to encourage
mm-hmm.
pedestrian traffic between neighborhoods. So there's a potential to make it into a site like how New York did the High Line
right.
walkway on a much smaller scale, like make it a feature. There's a lot of people that go there for exercise now. You
right.
see people running up and down the stairs carrying sandbags and things and doing push-ups on each level. But that could be integrated into the space if the city were to...
Sounds like a great new rec program.
As opposed to somebody who was interviewed in our book talked about back in the 40s taking the lids
taking
off their
them.
Ringer washer machines and tobogganing down the 100 steps onto Elizabeth Street, which is awesome.
It's probably not something the city wants to encourage right now.
No.
The Luge Training Center.
Luge Training. have you guys, I mean, I recognize this was a huge project, mapping the ward, but, you know, it's been a few years and, you know, isn't it time for a sequel?
I guess we have to leave that for the next influx of people.
Fair
well,
enough.
You know, for every story that's in here, we heard like 20 others, you know, which was an amazing thing. And it was a good project because it got people talking about all the things they loved about the neighborhood and things they remembered about the neighborhood and the changes. They'd seen it was interesting in some ways that it sort of Annie and I kind of slightly newcomers to the neighborhood, really having this appreciation for that diversity and that kind of Wild West feel that the ward still had. And I'm afraid that's going to really keep changing, you know, like, that some of those folks that have been there will be forced out in certain ways, and that character will be lost. But we've got great neighbors. I've got to say, we've got great neighbors. I feel very lucky to live there. And that's... I think that some of that character will be retained, because unlike developments in the South End or West End, the houses are close together.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you like it or not, you have to be negotiating with your neighbors, and that can be really fantastic. And it can be also extremely challenging. But I think the physical density of the ward and the fact that there's, you know, like there's this lack of homogeneity, that will still be retained. I know if I take like my daughter driving her to soccer practice in the South End, she would say, how does anyone know where they live? All the houses look the same. How do they find their houses? You know, like, whereas on our street, every house is so different. Yeah. Even the ones that were built kind of around the same time. There's so much character. And I think people will always be drawn to that.
I was worried for a second we're going to end on a bummer, but
you
picked it up there.
I think that you were asking before about what would we hate to see lost, and yep. I think it's part of that is the community, the sense of interest in the history of the neighborhood.
Mm.
People were really excited to have the opportunity to go to the Civic Museum and access the archives and learn about who had lived in their homes. They were interested in interviewing their neighbors. That sense of community was what we hoped this project would foster, as well as sort of usher in a new stage of development for the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think anyone can argue with you there. But but Janet and Annie, thank you so much for coming by today and talking about the ward.
Thanks, Adam.
We love the ward.
And once again, that was Annie Dunning and Janet Morton, the facilitators of the book Mapping the Ward, copies of which are hard to find, but it was published at PS Guelph, and you can ask them about getting your own copy, or maybe getting another one of a wide range of locally written and published books at facebook.com/PS Guelph, or at publication-studio.myshopify.com. There's also a Guelph Mercury column worth checking out by Andrew Vowles, a local author, and he wrote about the process of creating Mapping the Ward, and it's worth reading, and you can find that link in the show notes. And that is it for this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host of the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Sources Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And you can donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we'll have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you very shortly. And until then, see you next time.